Thank you to the organizers for the invitation to this workshop. I also want to apologize for my voice. I went to Chicago last week to the FOTS conference, and on the plane I caught a bad, terrible cold, and it's almost over, but still I'm coughing and my voice is not what it is expected to be. So this talk is about hypertree decomposition, and it's about problems whose structure can be described best by hypergraphs. Okay, and CSP constraint satisfaction problems are such problems, but there are also other problems. I will mention one or two other types of problems during this talk. So what is a constraint satisfaction problem? A constraint satisfaction problem consists of a set of variables, a set of constraints. So what is a constraint? A constraint is again consists of a scope which has a list of variables. A list of variables, that's the scope, and a relation that matches the arity or the number of variables in this scope. A relation, and so basically we can substitute these variables by one of these tuples, okay, in the relation. And so we have several such relations, several such constraints over the same set of variables, and together this constitutes a constraint satisfaction problem. And the solution to this constraint satisfaction problem is a substitution H, or a homomorphism H, or a substitution H, which translates all variables, so from the set of all variables to the domain of these relations, the joint domain of these relations, in the simplest case, such that for each constraint I, for each constraint Ci, H of the scope is, so this parenthesis should close here, H of Si, so the translation of this scope is one of these tuples, okay? So, close here. So, to each constraint satisfaction problem, you can immediately associate a hypergraph, so that basically the structure, the intricateness of a constraint satisfaction problem can be described by a hypergraph. A hypergraph is an abstraction, an abstraction which is quite close to the problem itself or to the instant itself. So the associated hypergraph is the hypergraph whose hyper edges consists of the set of variables of each constraint. So you have the first constraint. The first constraint has some variables x1 to xj or something like that. So the set x1 xj is one hyperedge. The next constraint has another set of variables that's another hyperedge. Okay. So the only thing you really lose here is, with respect to the scope, is the order of the variables. Okay. Everything else, the variables themselves are maintained. So here you have one typical constraint satisfaction problem that's a crossword puzzle. Actually, this is a simplified version of a crossword puzzle. So we have a number of, we have a list of words, okay, and so we can make one relation for words which consists of, yeah. Basically, for each of these fields, horizontal, vertical, we can have a list of words, okay, so that's the relation. And each of these fields could be interpreted as a scope. So these are variables, x1, x2, x3, x4, x5. And basically this list here must match one horizontal, one of these words. Okay? This list here must match one of these words, the verticals. Okay, one of these words, and so on. And of course, since we want to translate each variable only into one domain value, where the words cross, there must be the right value. Automatically, yeah, you know, that's automatically already contained in our definition. So as you see, this is basically, you can conceive a crossword puzzle as a constraint satisfaction problem. And if you look at the hypergraph here, well, the hypergraph just contains one hyperedge for these variables, one hyperedge for these variables, and so on. And so here we can very nicely see how the hypergraph, in some sense, corresponds to a constraint satisfaction problem, or in this case to a crossword puzzle, but yeah, in this case we even have a planar hypergraph, if you want. Okay? But that's not always the case. Also, we have to define what that is, actually. It's not relevant for this talk. Okay, another area which is very important where constraint satisfaction shows up is the database area. And in the database area we have conjunctive queries, the simplest and most used form of queries, conjunctive queries. So these are, here you have a database. I see that it goes a little bit out of the No? So here we have a database, and we have a query. Is there any teacher having a child enrolled in her course? Okay? Or his or her course, I should actually say, because there are male teachers too. So is there any teacher enrolled in his or her course? Is there any teacher having a child enrolled in his or her course? We can formulate this query as, well, the answer is positive, let's say yes. That could say also yes, that's just an atom which will be set yes, okay, or true. If enrolled SCR, so that if there is a student which is enrolled in a course, so here you have the enrolled relation, okay, and if there is a teacher teaches P the course, teaches this course, and then there is some assignment date which doesn't really matter here. And if P is a parent of S, so here we have a parent relation that you don't see. I probably will have to switch something on this laptop because, yeah, I think, sorry, by 1.5. Or do you know how to switch that to a lower resolution or something like that? Anybody knows it? So, is there any teacher having a child enrolled in her course? As you see, this is this query. And, well, we can associate this query to a hypergraph. And as you see, this hypergraph is cyclic. Even though I didn't explain you what cyclicity means so far, but that's obviously cyclic. Yeah, if it were a graph, it would be cyclic. As a hypergraph, it's also cyclic. So you see, student, course, professor, student. That makes the cycle, actually. Yeah. Now, we can also make, based on the same database, we can make the query, is there any teacher whose child attends some course? Attends. So, some course, but not the same course, taught by the same teacher. There are some course at the university. So that's a different query, of course. And basically the query differs because here the course is C prime and here the course is C. The course taught by the teacher is C and the course taken by the student is C prime. That's the only difference. And if you look at this hypergraph, it's obviously an acyclic hypergraph. Even if I didn't define the notion of hypergraph acyclicity so far, but that's obviously an acyclic hypergraph. Obviously an acyclic hypergraph. So, what do we know about the complexity of constraint satisfaction problems? So it's well known that constraint satisfaction problems are, in general, it's NP complete to check whether a constraint satisfaction problem has a solution, and therefore it's NP hard to compute a solution if a solution exists. One can see that very easily by using three-quarter ability. And one also knows, it's very well known, that constraint satisfaction problem or conjunctive queries, which are the same thing, which was already pointed out by Moshe and others in several papers, that this is a polynomial in case of acyclic hypergraphs. So if the constraint satisfaction problem or if the query has an acyclic hypergraph, then this can be done in polynomial time. So what is an acyclic hypergraph? I will give you a very short, very simple definition. A hypergraph is acyclic if it has a joint tree. What is a joint tree? A joint tree is an arrangement of the hypergraph or of the query. But you can also imagine that these are the hyper edges. Here I have written the query atom, so a query has a joint tree or a hypergraph has a joint tree. If we can arrange the hyper edges or the query atoms in a way, in form of a tree, such that we have the following, so such that every atom or every hyper edge appears at somewhere. So we have to really take all the atoms of the query and arrange it in form of a tree. And there's one additional condition. And this condition is called the connectedness condition. The connectedness condition says whenever we have one variable or a vertex of the hypergraph, that's the same as the variable of the query, okay? Each vertex, so if I take all the nodes of this tree that contains a specific vertex, let's say vertex P in this case, they form a connected subtree. That's the connectedness condition. Okay? Take S, they form a connected subtree. So if we had S only here and only here, let's say, but not here, that would violate the connectedness condition. Okay, so the connectedness condition says the subgraph of this tree spanned by those vertices that contain a particular vertex of the original hypergraph is connected. Okay? So that's the connectedness condition. And so if these two conditions are satisfied, then we say we have a joint tree, and then our query or our hypergraph is acyclic. And now I will show you very briefly the idea of Yanakakis' algorithm. So how can we solve an acyclic constraint satisfaction problem efficiently? How can we do that? Well, we have a join. Now we can say it's acyclic, therefore we have a join tree. Okay? And now we can work the join tree bottom up. Yeah? And we can say, okay, we have to, basically, what we have to do is every assignment to these variables and every assignment to these variables must be consistent in the Z and U assignments. Okay, because this has Z and U and this has Z and U, and I can assign only one value to Z and one value to U. So there must be consistency. Okay? Now, the primitive assignments, all the assignments here must be assignments from this relation. All the assignments here must be assignments from this relation. And the same here. The assignments between this and this must be consistent in the Z variable. Okay? The other variables here actually don't matter. Therefore, like I could assign to V, I could assign whatever is possible here. As long as the Z matches, I may contribute to a solution. Okay? So what we can do is, yeah, here we have that again. So here we have the Z variable, and we can now look for each single tuple and throw away those tuples for which no assignment is possible. Okay? So here we have a tuple 3, 8, 9. The Z is 8, but there is an 8 here. So this tuple matches with some of the tuples below. So it shouldn't be thrown away. Okay? Now I can continue. This 3 matches with the tuple here. Therefore, I will not throw it away. This 3 again, this 9, doesn't match with any tuple here because the second column is C, and there's no 9 here in the second column. There's a 9 in the first column, but this is done. It must match at the right place. Okay? So, this tuple will be eliminated. Okay? It cannot contribute, it could never contribute to a solution. Okay? And the next one is a 7, is also eliminated. Now I start at the other. Now these two must match these two, and they do the same job here. And I eliminate some tuples. Okay? So what does that mean? That means I have reduced this relation, and all the tuples, whichever tuple I take here, matches with both of these relations. Okay? And the other variables don't matter. I know that I can always substitute them in various ways, maybe, but I can substitute them. Okay? So what I have done here in terms of database theory is a semi-join or semi-join reduction. I have reduced this relation by so-called semi-joins by cutting off all the non-matching tuples. Okay? Now I can do the same thing going up with the reduced relation. I further reduce the top relation here. Okay? And I have reduced the top relation. I cannot reduce anything further. And what does it mean now? It means that every tuple which remains here matches with at least one tuple here, but every tuple here matches with both tuples with at least one tuple on the left-hand side, bottom element relation, and with the right-hand, with at least another tuple with the right-hand. So every tuple here is guaranteed to be part of a solution, and I can construct the solution now backwards by just choosing any tuple here and saying, taking any tuple that matches, so this matches this with this 3 here, and this matches with these two tuples, and combining these tuples, I get a solution. So basically, it's a very simple process. In order to solve an acyclic constraint satisfaction problem, I just have to do the semi-join upwards. And then it's clear that this has a good complexity, something like n square log n or something like that. Okay? So it's polynomial. I can also compute the result. But now the result is not always the set of all tuples that are in the result. But this could be actually exponential in the worst case. Yeah, because I could just do the join of several relations and have a large result. So the result could be of the set of all tuples, yeah, that are output of a constraint satisfaction problem, the set of all homomorphisms, if you want, could be exponential, of course. Yeah. So what we can say is, if the result is of polynomial size, then in the acyclic case, we can compute it in polynomial we can compute it in polynomial time, and we can in the acyclic case, we can compute the result in output polynomial time. So if it is large, we cannot do anything. We have to compute it anyway. So, but we don't compute it in the time which is exponential in the output. In polynomial time, polynomial in the output, we can compute it. So in case of acyclic queries, the result can be computed in time, polynomial in the result size. And even if the result is in polynomial size, it's generally hard to compute, because it's even hard to compute to know whether there is one single solution. Okay? And all this will remain true for the subsequent generalizations of acyclic conjunctive queries that I will present here in this tutorial. Okay, as I already explained, the result of acyclic conjunctive queries can be computed by adding a top-down phase to Yanakakis' algorithm. So exactly what you do first, the semi-join reduction, and then you start top-down from the root, and you expand the tuples in all possible ways, and every possible expansion will give rise to a different tuple, and so you are guaranteed to compute the result in output polynomial time. So what the first question that we asked, so we were working on this topic since 1998 or something like that, with my co-authors. We started with Carcello and Leone, and later on several other people joined the team, the hypertree decompositions team, basically. So the first question that we asked ourselves is, what's actually the precise complexity of Boolean conjunctive queries, of CSPs or Boolean queries that are acyclic? So we know that it's polynomial, but is it? What's the real complexity? What's the complexity? And what you see here is the table that Neil Immermann gave us yesterday. So that's a view of the complexity classes. So the bottom is logarithmic time hierarchy, first order AC0. Here we have the regular languages. Here we have what Neil calls the truly feasible fragment. And here we have polynomial time. And then we have the very high complexity classes. So where is this problem located in this hierarchy? And what we found out is that this problem is complete for this class log CFL. So we write it in a different way. We write log CFL as a word, but that's just notation. Log CFL. So what is log CFL? Log CFL is the class of all problems that are log space reducible to a context-free language. So that are basically not harder than deciding a context-free language. Membership in a context-free language. So again, So that's our theorem. Acyclic CSP solvability is log CFL complete, and answering acyclic Boolean conjunctive queries is log CFL complete. So it's the same problem, of course. So it's just, you know. Again, here you see log CFL. That's equal to SAC1. So what is SAC1? AC are alternating circuits. And what is SAC? So AC1 are alternating circuits with unbounded inputs, fan-in, with unbounded fan-in. Each gate can have an unbounded fan-in. And so both OR and AND gates can have unbounded fan-in. And the depth of the circuit is logarithmic. So that's the hardware with which you can do that in parallel. If you have a logarithmic circuit, so in logarithmic means many parallel steps, you can solve this problem. But these circuits are very special. AC1 means you can have AND gates with an arbitrary number of inputs and OR gates with an arbitrary number of inputs. Okay. Now, what is SAC1? SAC1 is semi-unbounded AC1. That means one type of the gates, either the OR gates or the AND gates, have only two inputs, and the other, or K inputs for a constant K, and the other type of gates has unbounded inputs. So this is a very strange class, and it's completely symmetric. You can have either the OR gate or the AND gate bounded. One of the two type of gates is bounded. If you have both types of gate bounded, then you go to the NC1 class. Okay. NC is another class of parallelizable problems where both types of gates are bounded, which looks a little bit more natural. Yeah? So we have this, but there is an intermingled hierarchy of AC and NC. I don't want to go there. But anyway, log CFL is equal to SAC1. So it's equal to all problems that can be solved with such parallel hardware that I just described to you. Yeah? Logarithmic circuit with one type of gate bounded and the other unbounded. The input, the fan-in So now let me, I will not show you the hardness proof. So in the hardness proof, what we actually do is reducing such circuits, exactly such circuits, to a constraint satisfaction problem, which is acyclic. Okay? But the reduction is rather complicated to explain, so I will not do that. But what I will try to do is to explain, to give you an intuition of why this problem that we have is actually in log CFL. Okay? The membership. So I will illustrate you the membership part of the proof. So imagine we have a joint tree here, okay, and we want to know whether there is a solution. So a joint tree, of course, every atom of the query or every atom, every scope of the constraint satisfaction problem is associated with a relation, this is associated with a relation, and so on. And what we have to do is we have to find substitutions of these variables such that this tuple here will be replaced by one tuple here, and this tuple here by one tuple here, and so on. Yeah. So, how can we do that? Well, first of all, I need some characterization. I need a characterization of log C of L that I didn't give you so far. And this characterization, let me go here again. This is a nice characterization by Rousseau that Rousseau found in 1980. So you see this class is very old, actually, which is a philosophical question whether a complexity class is old or not. Has it always existed? Or it was pointed out by Rousseau in 80. Yeah? So this is the class of all problems solvable with a log space alternating Turing machine with polynomial tree size. So you know that log space alternating Turing machines is equal to polynomial time. That's very well known. Yeah? Polynomial time is, I take log space, I use an alternating Turing machine that has universal and existential states. Yeah, and this is equal to p time. And if I do another restriction, namely I ask that the Turing machine has polynomial tree size, that means the proof tree, to prove, to witness that a problem is really is a yes instance, that an instance is a yes instance of such a machine. In order to witness that, what I would need to witness it is for each universal state, I need of course a witness for each of the follow-up states. But for each existential state, I need only one state. So you see the unbounded fan-in and bounded fan-in. The universal states are, correspond to the unbounded fan-in, and the existential states correspond to the bounded fan-in. So I need only one witness for one possible follow-up state. Okay? So that's, in general, the witness of an A-log space machine. A successful A-log space computation is exponentially large. Why that? Because during an A-log space computation, I have several times the same subproblem at several different parts of the trees. Okay? And that can expand and expand and expand. So in general, the witness would be exponentially large. But here I impose that I only accept witness such machines that guarantee a polynomially large witness. Okay? And that's log CFL. So let me show you how we can get polynomially large witnesses, and of course I will do that in a very schematic way. So what we need to do is for each of these, so we can start here with this tuple actually. The machine can start here and selects a tuple that matches x and y. Okay? So first of all, notice that this can be done in log space. We don't have to load the entire atoms or whatever on our workspace, but we can always work with pointers. Okay, so we have a pointer to our atom in the query, and we have a pointer to some tuple here, yeah, in the relation, and then we can systematically check whether, yeah, we can bind that without loading everything in our work tape. Okay, so now once we have done that, we will do for all the children, we have to check. For all the children, so that's a universal configuration, actually. So first we had an existential configuration by choosing that. Now we make a universal move and we say for all the children, and the children are there because you have the joint tree. Yeah. For all the children, we must make sure that this x, yeah, that this will be replaced by the same x. So basically we can do some existential move, but then we have to choose one tuple that can be done. And then we have to check that each x, that the x corresponds here, and that here the y corresponds, and so on. And this intuitively can be done. I don't explain you in detail how this is done, but it's a universal move. It says for all children, do something. Okay? And for each child, again, we have we select the tuple, then we, for each child again we do something and so on. So this is the alternation, and the alternation requires only log space, and the proof tree is actually polynomial, because the proof tree is isomorphic to our joint tree. We have here our joint tree, and once we have, this is the proof tree, this is a proof, okay? Once we have chosen the tuples, that's basically the proof, yeah? So the proof tree is in some sense induced by the shape of the proof tree is the same as the shape of the joint tree, and therefore we have a polynomial proof. So therefore the problem is in log CFA.
It's subtle here. You have, first of all, have to compute the tree decomposition in log CFA.
Yes, yes. No, I said, if for a given conjunctive query, for a given acyclic query, so A, it's not a tree decomposition, it's just an acyclic query. But you are right. I mean, the same thing will happen with tree decomposition. But here I speak about acyclicity. And computing a joint tree can be done in log CFL. But we show that in our paper, of course. So yeah, computing a joint tree can be done in log CFL. Computing tree decompositions can also be done in log CFL. Yeah?
Well, the point is that you assume here that you have a joint tree.
Yes.
My point was that you need to compute it first in log CFL.
Yeah, but either we assume that we have a joint tree, because if we have the same, if we have already a joint tree, the problem is not there. But if we don't have it, we have to compute it in log CFL, and composition of log CFL, log CFL function with a log CFL predicate gives again something in log CFL. That's also what we should have shown. So, yeah, it was known in to some extent. Okay? So everything can be done in log CFL. But you're right, I mean, one has to compute effectively the tree decomposition. Or the joint tree in this case. We don't still yet speak about tree decompositions. So if you look at the complex query, is this query hard? If you solve this query one can easily see it, I will immediately show you that this is not an acyclic query. Yeah? I will give you the intuition, this is not an acyclic query. Why? I will show you the hypergraph corresponding to this query. So, even believe me that this is not acyclic. Believe me that this is cyclic, okay? That's the hypergraph associated with this query, and it's obviously a cyclic hypergraph, yeah? Okay? And I can show you, I can prove that it's cyclic, okay? So, the question is, this was just proved by convincement, but I can
always... Proved by intimidation.
Proved by intimidation. Yes, proved by intimidation. So, what happens if we have such queries? I mean, so we said it's not possible. So now we have a very good instrument for handling acyclic queries. But if we have such a query, what can we do? Can we further analyze this query? I mean, it's not acyclic, but maybe it's nearly acyclic. Yeah. So we want to study in some sense the degrees of acyclicity of hypergraphs. So for graphs, there is a very, very nice theory of. It's really one of the most beautiful theories of the last century, let's say. It's the theory of tree decompositions, yeah, with graph miners and everything. So it's a beautiful theory by Seymour and Robertson and Thomas about what does the cyclicity, what does near cyclicity mean with graphs? And then, there are some other notions like click width and so on. But near cyclicity really is captured, the best way to capture this is through the notion of tree width. But here we have hypergraphs. And for hypergraphs, even cyclicity is not a completely trivial notion. Yeah? So we have to see. So as we see, this query with traditional methods, you would do the join between all these relations, and in the worst case, it would be O n to the m, where m is the number of atoms and n is the size of the database, or the largest relation of the database. Yeah? So in the worst case, you get a very high complexity in answering these queries, because you have really to join everything, yeah, and you don't know what will happen and so on. Yeah, and you make a lot of useless joins that later on, yes, if you cannot exploit the structure of the query in some sense, yeah, you cannot do semi joins as we did because we don't have so far a method for doing that. So as I said, despite its appearance, this query is actually nearly acyclic. It has degree of acyclicity 2, so it's very close, but the degree of cyclicity 2, and 1 is acyclic, and we will define these degrees later. So what I actually will aim at is to evaluate this query in a much better, with much better algorithms, namely m times n square log n time, okay? Where m is the number of atoms, so 11 times m square log n time. So of course, we are not the first to ask. We were not the first to ask what does it mean a nearly acyclic hypergraph. So there were several. There are several possibilities. So one possibility is to say we have this nice notion of tree width. So why don't we just take a graph out of the hypergraph? So we, for instance, we can take the Geifman graph of the hypergraph. Yeah. So or the primal graph. This the concept. This is named primal graph. Is much older. It was, I think, forged by Berge. Yeah. The primal graph of a graph. It just says two nodes are in the primal graph of a hypergraph. An edge is in the primal graph of a hypergraph if these two nodes happen to be together in a hyperedge, in some hyperedge. Okay. That's the primal graph or the Geifman graph. But there are other graphs. So there is the incidence graph. So you can have all the vertices and all the edges. So you have a bipartite graph basically, with the vertices of the original graph, the edges, and an edge between a vertex and an edge, or a hyperedge, if the vertex is contained in the hyperedge. That's a bipartite graph. And then there's the dual graph and other graphs. So we could, so let's just think, as since the results are all this very similar, not the same but similar, for our purposes, so let's just take the Geifman graph. So we could say, well, take a hypergraph, take its Geifman graph, and look at the tree width of this Geifman graph. Then we have a measure of acyclicity or of cyclicity of this hypergraph. So that would be a very reasonable step. But actually many people did that. We will see that it's not very satisfactory. So we could do that. So we say the tree width of a query or of a hypergraph is equal to the tree width of the Geifman graph of the query or of the Geifman graph of the hypergraph. Yeah? So that's, or if you want, the incidence graph or any other graph that that I can get out of the query. Then we get good things because the tree width for fixed k, checking whether the tree width is smaller or equal to k, is feasible in linear time. Agreeable, it's not a very practical algorithm, the linear algorithm, but in the meanwhile there have been quadratic algorithms which are not that bad and so on, which are actually for small values better than this linear algorithm. So this Bodländer has written several papers and has a collection of algorithms that in some that perform quite well in some in many cases. Computing a tree decomposition can also be done in polynomial time, actually in linear time, for fixed k, if k is fixed. Yeah. So I could look, does this Geifman graph have tree width 2 or 3 or 4? And we hope that in many practical examples the tree width will be very low, so that computing such a tree decomposition is still feasible in some sense. And, well, so therefore, and then it's known, if the tree width of this graph is bounded, then deciding whether CSP has a solution and finding a solution and everything can be done in polynomial time. Actually in log CFL, if you want to know the exact complexity. Yeah? So this, for one version of graph, namely for the incident graph, this was done by Chekuri and Rajaraman, and Kolaitis and Wadi did it for the Geifman graph. Okay? So that's, we have shown that this is also log CFL complete. That's very easy to see. Yeah? So what does it mean? It means if the graph associated with the hypergraph has bounded tree width, then the problem is solvable in polynomial time. And in log CFL, it's highly parallelizable. But now I will show you that this Geifman graph, for instance, is not a very nice graph because you lose a lot of information if you use the Geifman graph. So basically here you have the hypergraph. What is this Geifman graph? The Geifman graph, or the primal graph, consists here in this case, out of each edge you make a click. Okay? It's still far away. Yeah? So, don't panic, please. So, out of each edge, or out of each hyper edge, you make a click because you say two vertices of the original hypergraph are connected if and only if they happen to be together in some hyper edge, and that means a hyper edge gives rise to a click. So that means if my hypergraph was completely acyclic and consisted of a single hyper edge only, I would get a click as the Geifman graph. So you can imagine a click is has a very high tree width, while a single hyperedge is always acyclic. So something doesn't work very nicely here. Yeah? And the same, similar observations, not that bluntly, but similar observations can be made with any other way of associating a graph to a hypergraph, even with the incidence graph and with others. We have to be just to construct a few more complicated examples. So what is that? Yeah, here I just show you the tree width. So what is the tree width? So here we have a cyclic, what is a tree decomposition? Here we have a cyclic graph. Most of you already know this concept. We have a graph with some cycles, but which is not very, not strongly cycles. You don't have very big cliques or very big grids in it. Yeah. And here you have a tree decomposition of this graph. So a tree decomposition is an arrangement of the original graph in form of a tree where you have bags here, and these bags contain, these bags are basically sets of nodes of the original graph. And again, you have your connectedness condition. That means if I take all nodes in which H appears, for instance, H appears here, then this is a connected subtree. And whenever I have an edge between two vertices in the original graph, these two vertices must occur together in at least one bag. So these are the three conditions for the tree decomposition. So that's a tree decomposition. Okay? And the tree width of this tree decomposition is 2. It's the maximum number, the maximum size of a bag minus 1. Yeah? And the smallest possible tree width of any tree decomposition, that's the tree width of the graph. And in this case, it's 2. There's a very nice logical characterization of tree width. Again, by Colaitis and Vardy. So let's call the logic L. They call it in a different way, but I just call it L for simplicity. L is first order logic based on the existential, having only the existential quantifier and only conjunction. So it's positive first order logic, positive existential and conjunctive first order logic. Okay? No negation, no disjunction, no universal quantifier. So they denote it exists FO and plus. Okay? So this is actually the basic querying logic, because every conjunctive query can be expressed in that logic. This logic is a little bit more, how to say, succinct than just conjunctive queries, because conjunctive queries consists basically of this logic in predex form, where I have all the existential quantifiers at the beginning. But in this logic, I could also reuse variables, okay? And therefore, it's a little bit more succinct. But the expressive power is the same as conjunctive query, okay? So what Moshe and Fokion showed is that queries of tree with k exactly correspond to the lk plus 1 fragment of this logic. So with k plus 1, whatever I can express with k plus 1 variables corresponds to a query of tree with k. Okay? But we need reuse of variables here. And the basic idea is that if we have a tree decomposition, we use these variables for a bag, and one more variable maybe for going to the next bag, and then we can reuse the variables for the next bag, and so on. Yeah, because we can forget about everything which was, every variable which has disappeared is completely forgotten. That's this forgetfulness of tree decomposition.
You don't need one more variable. You need just the size of the bag.
You need the size of the bag. You're right. You need
which
the size.
A historical historical mistake, yes. I think, by Mapion, by Robertson and Seymour. Because now we have to drag the plus 1.
Yeah, this plus 1 is very... You need exactly the size of the bag, because you need the bag, and you have the intersecting variable for the next bag, which are already quantified, for which we have some quantifiers, and the remaining quantifiers you need for the new variables of the bag, but in total you never use more than k, plus 1. Okay. But there's also a very nice game theoretic characterization of tree width by Seymour and Robertson, and that's the robber and cops game. And I will just show you. Here we have a robber, female robber, but you can also say the cops are also female, so it's not no discrimination here. Yeah, it's just
robbers.
Yeah. And so there are cops that fly with a helicopter, a certain number of cops that fly with a helicopter and want to track the robber. The robber can see the cops approaching. The cops can sit also on some vertices of this graph. And the robber cannot run over a vertex where the cops are sitting. Yeah? So, for instance, the cops can go here. If the cops go here, then the robber has this. Take care. The robber has this as a escape space. Okay? Now this cop can fly now to this point, for instance. Okay, now the robber has this, and now this cop can fly here and trap the robber. Okay, so that's the game. And so it's a very natural game, actually. And again, a graph has tree with k if k plus one cops can trap the robber in this game. Okay? If and only if. So it's a nice characterization. Again, so I said a lot of nice things about tree decompositions here, but the problem is, again, the one I already pointed out, that even if we have an acyclic hypergraph where everything should be easy, we get clicks in our primal graph. And if the hyperedges become larger and larger, these clicks become larger and larger. And so we can easily design very simple polynomially tractable fragments of conjunctive queries that have unbounded unbounded tree widths. Okay? So that's not, tree width is not really, it destroys, there's an information loss basically from this hypergraph to the graph. And so tree width is, in my opinion, in our opinion, was not a nice notion. Yeah? Well, and that happens for all possible, graphs that I can take, that I can generate from a hypergraph. For all those which have been considered so far. So basically there was a quest, yeah, is there something which describes better, which better describes the structure of a hypergraph, yeah, without having to go to a graph? Can we operate directly on the hypergraph, and can we define a measure, a direct measure of acyclicity of hypergraphs? Okay? And so there have been several proposals. So one proposal was bounded degree of cyclicity by Heisens and Paradens, and Heisens, Jevons, and Cohen. And this is a nice measure, but it's not very powerful. So we can also here, one can easily design classes for which it's obvious that for which it's obvious that they are polynomially tractable, yeah, but they get a very high bounded degree of cyclicity. So this is actually a somewhat outdated measure.
What and do they do to delete nodes?
What they do is they do biconnected components. They do biconnected components. They find the biconnected components in the hypergraph and take basically the sets of biconnected components. That's vaguely, yeah. And it's not, it doesn't tell you very much, because the biconnected component can be complex, can be still be decomposed, but they don't decompose it.
What happens if you ask how many nodes do you need to delete before it becomes a secret?
Yeah, this is a very bad measure. Sorry, but it's a bad measure because if you have, let me show you. We dealt with such things. If you have a query that looks like that, lots of triangles, then you have to delete a lot of nodes to make it acyclic. But obviously this query can be solved in cubic time and not in time. If you have n thousand such graph that consists of thousand such separated components, triangles, you don't want to have thousand in the exponent, but with this method you would get thousand in the exponent. Okay? You want to get three in the exponent because you do it completely in parallel with all triangle. Yeah? Okay. So there has been another measure which is called bounded query width. And that's a measure that sounds very interesting because it was a kind of, how to say, paradigm switch. Yeah? And the paradigm switch consisted in the following idea. Instead of grouping together, instead of counting variables, let's count the hyperedge that we have to lump together in some sense. Let's lump together not variables but hyperedges, yeah, in order to find the kind of decomposition, and then just count the hyperedges, because it's actually matching a single hyperedge. When I match a hyperedge, I automatically match several variables together. So why should I count that for each variable? I'm doing a hyperedge match. Yeah? So that was a good idea. And we can see here, for instance, this query. This is a query with, if I take the graph of this query, I get a very high tree width, because it has n, I have n variables here in one atom, and therefore I get a click of size n if I consider the tree width. Okay? Even if I look only at this atom. But if I do a query decomposition, so what do they do? A query decomposition basically is a tree with bags, and the bags lump together hyper edges and not variables. Okay, so here I can do every hyper edge by itself. Yeah, the connectedness condition will be satisfied and everything. So immediately I can see this is a query decomposition. It has query with one because I have only one hyper edge or only one atom, one query atom equal to hyper edge of a hypergraph. Yeah, per bag. Okay. Here is another query. Here you have a query decomposition of width 2. Here I have to take at least one bag has two hyper edges here. You see? Or two atoms. I now very sloppily use the word atom and hyper edge. Yeah? The atom is of the query and the hyper edge is of the hypergraph of the query. But since we decompose hypergraphs or queries, let me use these things as synonyms for the moment. Yeah? I hope it. So this is a query decomposition. And what Chakuri and Rajaraman, they were students of Ullman, Jeff Ullman, have shown is that Boolean conjunctive queries or constraint satisfaction problems can be solved in polynomial time for bounded query width. So here the query width is 2, therefore you can solve it in polynomial time. Basically in n to the 2 times log n, something like that. Yeah? N square log n. So why? Let me give you a very brief explanation why this is so. The explanation is the following. So here we have our query decomposition. So what we can do is we can transform this query, which I have so decomposed in this way, into an acyclic query just by joining, by making joints between the relations of that are in the single bags for each bag. So here we can say, okay, instead of having a relation, two relations, gxy and txyz, let's make one relation, gtxyz, and e. So this g and t, and I make the join of these two, okay? G join t, that's the relation that corresponds to this, okay? And if I do that, if I join these relations, then I get an acyclic query at the end. And for acyclic queries, we know that they are polynomial, actually log CFL, and joining this is very easy, that can be done in log space, okay? Tuple by tuple. And since I have only bounded a constant number of queries, this doesn't explode in some sense. Okay, it could be. The exponent is of course k of the new relations. So you see that's the simple explanation why this works. Yeah. And well, there were big problems by Chakuri and Rajaraman. So the big problem was, can I recognize whether a query or a hypergraph has bounded query width in polynomial time? Yeah? So are the following problems solvable in polynomial time for fixed k? Decide whether query q has query width at most k and compute a query decomposition, because that's what I, as Moshe correctly pointed out, I need such a decomposition. Yeah? If I don't have such a decomposition, I cannot use my polynomial algorithms. So we should also take into account the effort of computing such a decomposition. Unfortunately, this has a negative answer. Deciding whether a query has query width at most k is NP-complete. And actually, we showed that for 4, but in the meanwhile, we have seen that even for query decomposition equals to 2, it's NP-complete. Yeah, so there's nothing to do. Query decomposition, it's very hard to check whether a query has a query decomposition, even a very low width query decomposition or query width. Yeah? So that's the big problem. Of course, if we have the same query, which is fixed in some sense, and we execute this query millions of times over a database, then it's still worthwhile even of solving this NP hard problem. Yeah? But maybe we can do better. So that's what I want to go into now. So let me first give you a very brief intuitive account on why this is NP-hard, okay? So let's try to, we have a query, and let's imagine we are in the middle of constructing a query decomposition for this query. We want to construct a query decomposition. And imagine we don't have this. We have these two, and we have this maybe, and we have these two. Now, here you have an X, and here you have an X, okay? Here, imagine we don't have this atom. So there's no X here. That's what we have constructed so far for whatever reason. Yeah? So what we need is, we need to fill in some atom here, like this one, with an X, because we must bridge these X's here. Yeah? We must bridge this, because why must we bridge this? Because of the connectedness condition. Otherwise, it wouldn't be connected. The decomposition wouldn't be connected. We would have an X here, but not in the middle. And that violates the connectedness condition. Okay? So we fill in some atom here in order to remember this X. Yeah? But while we fill it in, we create a new problem. We create a problem that we disconnect the Z. Okay? So that smells like NP completeness, of course. In order to fix one thing, we create another problem. Yeah? So that's basically the problem. So, but the proof is rather hard. But we made an interesting observation. We said, well, if I have to fix something, I reuse some atom that has already appeared somewhere else to fix something. Since I reuse that atom, I could actually create a new query, basically, with a Z prime here, and not with a Z. Because XYZ already exists here. Yeah. So the Z already exists, and it must already exist, because otherwise I wouldn't have a violation. Yeah. So in this case, even the entire atom exists. So in order to, what I could do is I could make another query and say, this C prime is completely irrelevant because I want to fix the X here. Okay? So add an atom to the query with Z prime, with a new variable. I'm sure if this query succeeds, also the old query succeeds because it's a super query. But if the old query succeeds, this also succeeds because I can just take any value for any matching value, in particular the value for Z. It's a subquery. Yeah. So this query is a super query. This query with C prime is a super query. It's a subquery. It's contained in the query, but it's a super query as a syntactic construct, let's say, as a set of atoms. So, I mean, it's subtle. It's contained. It's by query containment in the other query. But it's a super query because I've added a literal, an atom. Okay? So by adding a new atom, I can be a little bit more liberal with fixing things. Yeah? Okay? And the NP completeness would go away. But I haven't the same query. I have another query. But so basically we said, we took that basically as the basic idea. Query atoms can be used. So instead of adding a new variable here, we just said, okay, actually, it's completely irrelevant. This variable will appear only one time in the query. We can just write an underscore instead of that variable. Or basically, we could use the projection of this P to the first two arguments. Okay? So we could use an underscore. So the basic idea is query atoms can be used partially as long as the full atoms appear somewhere else. Yeah? And that's more liberal than query decomposition. It's clear. Much more liberal because I can... Yeah, more queries will have this hypertree decomposition. So basically what we here, we instead of writing the Z prime, we just write an underscore. Okay, and we use this partially. So, but this can only be done because this atom already exists somewhere. So we have a new concept now of decomposition where we can use atoms partially. And now that's our original query with the horrible intimidating hypergraph. So if we use this concept, then, as you see, this has hypertree with 2. So that's hypertree with, basically. That's the basic idea of hypertrees. But actually what I have shown you so far is called generalized hypertree with. One condition is missing. So what is a hypertree decomposition? A hypertree decomposition is such a decomposition where I can use atoms that appear somewhere else, partially in some other place. Okay? Atoms which every atom has to occur fully somewhere, but it can occur partially in some other place. And we have the connectedness condition. So for instance, if I take all those bags where F occurs, it's a connected subtree. Okay? And now I need another condition because we will see that this is not yet what we need. But anyway, that's a generalized hypertree decomposition. So let me give you an alternative view of generalized hypertree decomposition. An alternative view of a generalized hypertree decomposition. So here I have a hypergraph. And here I have a tree decomposition. So I could define a generalized hypertree decomposition in the following way. I could say a generalized hypertree decomposition of width 2 is equal to a tree decomposition any tree decomposition such that I can cover the each bag of the tree decomposition by two hyper edges. So let's see. I have the first bag is covered by these two hyper edges. Okay? The next bag is covered by these two hyper edges. The next bag is covered by these two hyper edges, and so on. This is covered by only one, but by at most two, of course. So this is covered by two. This is covered by two. This is covered by two. And the last one also. So that's called a generalized hyper tree decomposition. Yeah? So it has two aspects basically to it. It has the aspect of a tree decomposition plus the aspect of covering. And this covering makes it a little bit harder than tree decomposition. Because as we all know, set covering is not such a trivial affair. So here I announce a result which has not yet been published, but it's due to Thomas Schwentig, basically. I hope you don't mind if I announce it, if it turns out to be wrong. Yeah.
If it's true, I don't mind.
It is true. Yeah. So, can we determine in polynomial time whether the general hypertree of a query or of a hypergraph is smaller or equal than k? So that this problem is NP-complete, even for k equals 4. Okay? So we are writing a paper where this result will be in and some other generalizations and so on, so I hope it will come out. That has been done 1 year ago, but we had not the time. Due to various moves, we didn't have the time to write it up.
Can you say again what's the difference between the generalized and the non-generalized?
Yes, I come to that. Yes? So, actually it's here. A hypertree decomposition is equal to the general hypertree, so the general is NP-complete. So we cannot do with the general. Yeah? It's equal to the generalized plus a special condition. So what is this special condition? The special condition says whenever a variable... So this is a sloppy... I give you a sloppy definition, yeah, of it. It's sloppy, admittedly, but it's very easy to remember. It's not very precise. Basically, each variable that has disappeared... So we had some variable, jxy. So this j atom was here with... in full, and every atom must be somewhere full. Yeah, this atom has disappeared. These variables have disappeared. Underscores. Yeah, basically, I killed these variables here. I use that to bridge these two, and I don't need these variables because if I put them, I would get another problem. Each variable that disappeared at some vertex v of the decomposition does not reappear in the subtree rooted on v. Okay, so whenever a variable disappears, it doesn't reappear. I know that this is sloppy, but let's...
But this is hypertree with additional condition, right?
No, this is generalized hypertree with an additional condition. So this is hypertree with.
Okay.
This is hypertree with. It's a little bit sloppy because you could say, well, several variables could disappear. One can make it very clear, but that's the... Yeah. Imagine you have a name for each atom, and then it's clear. Yeah. Okay? So that's an additional condition. So this condition, is this condition very restrictive? Is it, for instance, more restrictive than query decomposition? We want to have something more general than query decomposition, yeah? If possible. Is it more restrictive? No, because in query decomposition, nothing ever disappears. You always take the full atoms, okay? So it's still more general than query decomposition. And it's with this, and this condition makes it tractable. It makes finding a hypertree decomposition tractable. Okay, let me... Here we have a hypertree decomposition, but it doesn't give anything. So let me give you some positive results on the hypertree decomposition. The hypertree width, as I just said, is always smaller or equal to the query width of a query or of a hypergraph. And in many cases, it's effectively smaller because I can still use partial atoms, yeah, and therefore getting to the better decomposition. For fixed...
How much smaller?
At least three times smaller. Not unboundedly many, but three times. Yeah. for fixed k, deciding whether the hypertree is smaller than k is feasible in polynomial time, actually in log CFL. So you get your answer. Computing a hypertree decomposition can be checking whether something has bounded hypertrees, and computing a hypertree decomposition can be done in functional log CFL. And if I combine functional with decision for log CFL, I get again log CFL. Computing a hypertree decomposition is feasible in polynomial time, but here comes the difference. the difference between query decomposition and between tree decomposition and Hydro tree decomposition, we have to pay a price. It's not fixed parameter tractable. Computing tree decomposition is fixed parameter tractable because it's linear. Okay? It's linear and only the linear factor for each k is different. Computing hypertree decompositions is fixed parameter intractable. That means for each k, with k, if we want to check whether a hypertree decomposition of with k exists, we have n we have a size of the query to the k or something like that. So the k will be the exponent of the size of the query or of the size of the hypergraph. Yeah? And that's unavoidable because what we are doing here is, as I have said, the formula is very simple. Hypertree decomposition is equal to tree decomposition plus matching, plus set covering. And set covering itself is already fixed parameter intractable. And that's what we buy. That's the virus we get from set covering, basically, this fixed parameter intractability. But it's still, of course, worthwhile to do a hypertree decomposition, especially if the k is small. And what we think in practice, we don't have any proof of this, but we have looked at many queries and have most queries that you find around have a very low hypertrivis, but can have a higher higher trivis. So now we can evaluate a CSP or a query having bounded hypertrivis. Give me a database of relations and a constraint satisfaction problem or a query Q over this database whose hypertrivis is bounded by K or whose generalized hypertrivis is bounded by K. If by magic I can get for free the generalized hypertrivis, then deciding and give me a K hypertree decomposition of the query Q, deciding whether Q is solvable in is feasible in n to the K plus 1 log n, where n is the size of the database. N is actually the size of the largest relation in the database. Yeah? And this is not very astonishing because, again, I can do the same trick that I have shown before with query decomposition. I first transform the query, the hypertree decomposed query into an acyclic query. And this transformation is exactly the same. I just do the join. Yeah. Maybe I have to do some projection in addition because some variables are missing. Okay. Here is something that relates to trivis and the hypertrivis. So if a hypergraph H has n vertices, then the hypertrivis is at most n half plus 2. The hypertrivis cannot be larger than n half plus 1. Sorry, n half plus 1. Okay? Whereas the trivis can be n minus 1. So that means even in case, we are only interested, even in case of single hyper edges and so on, even in case of graphs, actually, the hypertrivis can be larger than can be half the trivis, which is of course useful to know because we can exploit this in our evaluation mechanisms. So here we have studied, we have compared hypertree decompositions with a large number of other graph decomposition of other ways of recognizing polynomial feasibility of constraint satisfaction problem. In particular, these are all, in some sense, methods for rendering a graph or a hypergraph acyclic. One method is the one that Moshe already said, take away the necessary set of nodes so that the graph becomes acyclic. That's cycle cut set, actually. That's what you asked. This method is here. And then there are other tree clustering, the trivis method. That's biconnected components, hinge decomposition. That's the decomposition that I mentioned by Jevons and Cohen and Heisens. And you have cycle hypercut set and other methods. And an arrow here means that a method outperforms another method. Outperforming means there some method, the lower method, has classes with unbounded trivis, but the upper method has bounded trivis for these classes and not vice versa. Now that means this arc. So that this is at least as good as this and better for some classes. Okay? So as you see, for the moment, hypertree decomposition is a very good measure. Yeah? General hypertree decomposition is a little bit better, but not really. So let me go into that. So, but first let me show you a an interesting relationship between general hypertrivias and hypertrivias. So the general hypertrivias of a hypergraph H is equal to the hypertrivias of H star, where H star is H union all E prime, where E prime are subsets of the edges. Of course, this set is exponential. I take all subsets of edges, yeah, and then I get the general hypertrivias. So the general hypertrivias allows you, yeah, to use any partial edge as often as you want, and not, you don't have any special condition that blocks you for using a partial edge. And here is a result that shows that the hypertrivias between, so hypertrivias is smaller than, the hypertrivias is smaller than 3 times the general hypertrivias, okay, at most, plus 1. So basically, hypertrivias is not a bad approximation of generalized hypertrivias. It's, yeah, it has an approximation factor 3. It's an approximability result in some sense. Yeah. So here we have general hypertree decompositions, here we have hypertree decompositions. Actually, this arrow is not really correct. I should make it a dash, because this can never be unbounded when this is unbounded, because there's a factor 3. Okay? So that should be a dashed arrow, actually. So the question is, are there other approximations to generalized hypertrivias? And, well, recently, Jevons and Cohen and Heisens have published, based on the ideas of hypertrivias, another decomposition called spread cuts. But it turned out that spread cuts are actually not polynomially recognizable. And then they can refine it. They haven't done it yet, but it's easy to see that it can be refined, so you can have a smaller notion that this is normalized spread cuts. So this is a notion which is not comparable to hypertree decomposition, and it is polynomially computable. So there are other notions. It's not quite a very large class, but it's still large enough for being incomparable with hypertrivias. And it's not clear, we don't know very much about this class so far. So we don't know, for instance, if this really three approximates general hypertree decompositions. I don't think so. Okay? So it's probably not a good approximation of general hypertree decomposition as far as we have seen, but we don't have formal proof. And so the question is, can we get closer? This has not been shown so far. Can we get closer? So if an area to investigate in the future is this area here. So we should explore this area. That's what we want to do. And we have some ideas how we can get better than hypertrivial decomposition. So more general than hypertrivial decomposition. But of course, there's another question. Are there tractable classes of constraint satisfaction problem? Are all tractable classes of constraint satisfaction problem of bounded generalized hypertrivias? There is a similar result by Grohe and Schwentig and Segoufin and Grohe, Schwentig and Segoufin. Yeah. When is a conjunctive query tractable? But this basically considers only query over databases of bounded arity. And there it can be shown a class of conjunctive queries is tractable if and only if the class has bounded trivias. Yeah? But this is only true for bounded arity, yeah? For fixed arity. What we hypertrivias takes care of large arities, so a very large edge, is still tractable, is still an acyclic query. Yeah? So a similar result does not hold, and that was recently shown by Grohe and Marx. Not Martin Marx, but
Karl Marx.
Not Karl Marx. I forgot the first name, but Daniel Marx. Okay. So they have shown that there exists a class of queries which are tractable, and don't have bounded generalized hypertrivias. This is called fractional hypertree decompositions. But we do not know whether this class of queries is polynomially recognizable. So far, I have to say, in defense of hypertrivias is the only class of which we know it approximates generalized hypertree decomposition and it's polynomially recognizable. But of course, it shows us that we have very interesting another interesting area to explore, and that's the area above generalized hypertree decompositions. And I guess we can find something interesting here, yeah, and something tractable, recognizable. Okay, let me, I have some minutes left, quarter of an hour or so. So let me give you now this is a games workshop, so I haven't said very much about games so far, so let me finish with some considerations about games. So I have said something about games. I have shown you the Robbers and Cop game. But what happens with hypertrivis? Is there a game that characterizes hypertrivis? So first let me give you a logical characterization and then the game theoretic one. But it's very easy to see that they are closely related. So what are guarded formulas, the guarded fragment of first order logic? The formula is guarded if whenever I have, for instance, I'm speaking only about existential formulas here, if I have an existential quantifier and the formula phi, I add some atom here, atom G, that's the guard atom, and this atom contains all free variables of phi. Okay? So the free variables of phi are captured in some sense by this guard. And now I can generalize this and I can speak about K-guarded logic. K-guarded logic is if instead of having only one atom that captures all these, that contains all these free variables, I have K atoms that all together contain all the free variables. So instead of having a guard that consists only of one atom, I can consider a K guard that consists of a conjunction of K atoms. Okay? So the guarded fragment, even the K guarded fragment, with some, the K-guarded fragment, as Thomas Schwabe recently pointed out, with some difference. Yeah, it's not as simple as I explained it here, but still another version of the K-guarded fragment, are pretty well understood and were studied, for instance, by Van Bentham and by Gödel. And, well, I have a very simple guarded. My definition of K-guardedness just says you need K atoms, and these atoms altogether should capture the free variables. But no, it's not necessary that they are linked by some path or whatever. Yeah? Okay. So what is the logical characterization of bounded hypertrivis? So remember this logic L. L is the logic of existential, that has only existential quantifiers, conjunctions, but no negation, no universal quantifier, no disjunction. Okay? That's the query logic, L. It's a positive logic just for existential queries. And that's the logic, that's what we are interested in here. A query has hypertrivis K if and only if it's in the guarded fragment, in the K guarded fragment of L. Okay? And basically, from this general result, we also get a very nice characterization of the acyclic queries. That's just the case one. A query is acyclic if it has hypertrivis 1, then it has a joint tree, okay? A query has hypertrivis 1 if it is acyclic, if it is in the guarded fragment of L. So the guarded fragment are exactly the acyclic queries. I mean, that's a very simple observation. Maybe somebody else has made it, but we haven't found it, unless Moshe says you have already made it, yeah? But
Newton made it.
Newton, yes. So it's a very simple observation. It doesn't cost us, but it's, I think it's a nice characterization of acyclicity. Yeah, acyclicity and guardedness correspond. And well, here you have an example, and this example will show you, in some sense.
In a sense, it's almost in one of the definitions of acyclicity, really.
Yes, but it was not. I mean, it's just. I mean, we have a stronger theorem here, but it's just case one, and it's worthwhile at least saying it. Yeah. So. Let me give you an example here. So here we have an example. Let me see now. Yeah. So here we have a query. We have an acyclic query. We have the joint tree of this acyclic query. And well, there exists indeed an equivalent guarded formula. And what does the formula do? We start with the root. Okay. P of x, y, z. There exists an x, y, z such that P of x, y, z. There must exist some variables, some substitutions for x, y, z. Therefore, we say there exists x, y, z such that P of x, y, z. And now we go here. We go to this, and then we make another subformula which will take care of this subtree. So one subformula is taking care of this subtree, and the next subformula takes care of this subtree. And the important thing is, again, I can simply take these atoms as guards, and this will be guarded because of the connectedness condition of this joint tree, basically. Yeah, because the connectedness condition says I cannot have some arbitrary variable popping up at some point. Yeah, whatever I have is either already present or will be new, but will not be, will not never come back to the same variables, and therefore I can use this as guard. So there exists a TQ of X, Y, T, and there exists a W. So whenever there is a new variable, I quantify it existentially over this variable. I have this, and due to the connectedness condition, I'm guaranteed that this query is guarded, basically. Yeah? So this is... So here we have guarded subformulas. And whatever, so the connectedness condition says, whatever variable, so I'm in a subquery, and some variables point upwards. But the connectedness condition says that, given that these variables point upwards, they must already be present in the atom that I had just had before. Okay, so that's in this guard. Okay, now let's come to the game characterization, finally, because we are game workshop. So now we don't have the robber and cops game any longer, we have now the robber and marshals game. Marshals are much more powerful than cops. In fact, atoms are more powerful than variables. Yeah? So the marshals correspond to atoms. A marshal is a kind of super cop that can block an entire atom instead of blocking just a single variable. Okay? So we have the robber and marshals game. A robber and K marshals play the game on a hypergraph, and the marshals have to capture the robber. And here we have an instance of the marshal game. So here we have again our robber here, yeah. And now a marshal can block an entire hyper edge. So two marshals, yeah, put themselves here and they block these hyper edges. And basically the escape space of the robber is only this. And now there is, in this game, there is a clear definition of which nodes have to remain blocked when the marshals move. The intersection between two positions must remain blocked. So the marshals can only move in such a way that when they move from one position to another position, those nodes which are in the intersection, in this case these nodes here, remain blocked. Okay? So that's the rule of the game. Otherwise the robber could escape through such a node. Okay? So now you see that this marshal is free to capture the robber. Okay? Now there is another condition in this robber and marshal game, which I haven't mentioned, but which is very important, which I will mention now. The game must be monotonic. So the escape space, you know what the escape space is? It's the sub-hypergraph, or it's the sub-area where the robber still can freely move, and the robber can always move along edges, hyper-edges. The escape space must monotonically shrink. In the robber and cops game, it was shown by Seymour and Thomas, or even by Seymour and Robertson, I don't remember this moment, that the monotonic and the non-monotonic version are the same. Whenever I have a non-monotonic strategy to capture a robber, then I have also a monotonic strategy with the same number of cops. Okay? This is not the case here with in hypertree decomposition. Isolde Adler, a student of Grohe, has shown and we have also noticed that by examples, but she has given a very nice formal example that non-monotonic capturing can be faster with less. You can capture non-monotonically a robber with less marshals, with fewer marshals than monotonically. Yeah? But, so why don't we then resort to non-monotonic capture? The reason is non-monotonic capture doesn't give us a strategy for answering a query. Yeah? Only the monotonic capture does. Yeah, so it doesn't give us anything similar to hypertree decomposition. At least we don't know what to do with such a non-monotonic strategy. So we are bound to monotonic strategies here. Okay? Okay, now the theorem is obvious. Let H be a hypergraph. H has a hypertree with smaller equal K, even only if K marshals. So here we don't have the K plus one problem. Yeah? Even only if K marshals have a winning strategy on H. H is acyclic if and only if one marshal has a winning strategy. Winning strategies correspond to hypertree decompositions and vice versa. So a winning strategy is actually a hypertree decomposition. Now, I have a proof argument. So now, I told you this theorem. it is in logCFL to check whether a hypergraph has hypertrivies bounded by some k. Okay, I didn't give you any hint, so let me try to give you a very very abstract hint how this could be proved. So, and we will use the Marshall games instead of hypertree decompositions. The Marshall game, the Robert Marshall games, is much easier to handle. So the game, actually, we can use the game to show this positive result, namely that checking whether the hypertree decomposition of whether a query has hypertree decomposition of a, with k for some constant k is polynomial. So let's imagine k equals 4, yeah, for simplicity. We want to know whether a query has hypertree decomposition, hypertree with 4. So we play the Robert and Marshall game. So we have a Marshall position R. That's maybe a wrong, not a nice name, because Robert starts with R, but these are the Marshall positions here. So this is, we have a Marshall. So imagine that we are in the middle of this game. So what is, you need a Marshall position. The Marshall position can be identified with in log space, because it's only 4, in this case, 4 hyperedges. Okay? So you have a Marshall position, and this Marshall position defines an escape space. The escape space is basically the component of the hypergraph, or the set of components, not necessarily, no, it's one component. So you have several, so if you block, if the Marshalls block these nodes, then you can have several components. And you're looking at one component, and you can treat each component separately. So basically this is the universal step, treat each component, continue to chase the robber in each component. Okay? That's the universal step in our alternating Turing machine that we are constructing. Yeah? So let's now look what happens with one component. So imagine we have here one component that is due to the blocking of these four hyperedges of the Marshalls in position R. So what we have to check is so the robber is here in, and the robber will be in one of these sub. So what we have to find is we have to find a new position. And the only thing, there are two things that this new position should, that this new Marshall position should satisfy. So one thing is the component should become smaller. Yeah? Why? So we have chosen one component, so we want to go to one of these subcomponents, basically. Yeah? From the component to a smaller subcomponent. And in parallel to all smaller subcomponents. Yeah? Secondly, the robber should not be able to escape. So what does it mean the robber should not be able to escape? Well, that's also monotonicity in a certain sense, yeah? It says for each edge, this basically that's connected with monotonicity. For each edge E in this component, I'm looking for this blue set of, for this blue set of robber positions, yeah? If there is an edge here that goes somewhere out, it must go through the blue element, because if it goes out and does not, it's not completely cut, it's not completely contained actually in the blue element. So every edge that is here in the new set, in the new component or whatever, which goes out of this red area, should be, the rest of it which is not in the red area should be in the blue area. That says the robber cannot flee. If there was one edge, one single edge that goes out, the robber could flee through this edge. Yeah? So that's a very simple condition. So what I can do is now in logCFL, in log space, enumerate all possibilities of four new Marshalls, seeing whether the component shrinks, whether I get to one subcomponent actually, or several subcomponents, and satisfy this single condition that the robber cannot flee. And that's it. And it's easy to see that this can be done in logCFL actually, or if you want an alternating log space. Okay? So that's just a very high level idea. You have to implement that, of course, and to see that it's really possible. Okay. Last point, since we are in a games workshop, hypertree decompositions can not only be applied to constraint satisfaction problems or queries or similar problems, to homomorphism problems, but also to other problems. And here we have a new problem. That's a new thing which is not yet published. We are dealing with combinatorial auctions. So what is a combinatorial auction? So you are an auctioneer and you want to sell several things. Yeah? Here in this case we have teacups, we are in England, so teacups abound. There are teapots and teacups. Okay? So you want to sell that. And now there are several bidders coming into the play. And so for instance, one bidder bids on this cup this is a cup with the Pope on it, I guess, or something. And on this, teapot. So this is, of course, it does not even color-wise correspond, but it's not our role to say to the bidder, you shouldn't buy this color combination, that's kitsch. Yeah? We want to sell. Yeah? So whatever these guys buy is good for us. And the bidder gives a price. So this is a hyper edge with a prices, with a price tag, with an integer rational number attached to it. Okay? And now other bidders come. And so you see different bidders, or even the same bidder can make two bids for different sets. Yeah, bidders can bid on sets of things, and usually they want to have one teacup, one teapot and one teacup, or one teapot and several cups. Yeah, so these cups are all sold together. Yeah, and so on. Some are very have a good taste, like this one. Some have a bad taste. Yeah. Anyway, this is, for instance, there's a hyper edge here. That's a teapot collector. Yeah, he's not interested in cups. He has a big, huge collection of teapots, but he already has these pots, so he's only interested in these three teapots. Yeah. So as you see, and all the bidders give their prices here. So for each bid, you have a price, and what you have is a hypergraph. Yeah. But so this problem, computing the what I want to do as an auctioneer now is, I want to sell. What does it mean? What does such a bid mean? Such a bid means either I want to buy this, so this bidder wants to pay £57, but only if he gets both things together or nothing. So that's the special thing of a combinatorial auction. Either both or nothing. And I'm willing to pay £57 for both. Yeah? So what we as auctioneer need to do is to find a good subset of the vertices that are completely disjoint. So it's a set splitting problem, actually, in some sense. Yeah? With a maximum amount. And here you have one. So, and you see, if you look at this, you can see that the problem is NP-complete. You can just feel it. Because, look at this. So if you start to say, okay, we can have these two, 50 plus 57, that's 107. That's more than 105. So let's take these two together. But as soon as you take these two, you destroy any possibility of these guys to buy something. And actually, you drift away from your optimal solution, which is this one, I guess, at least. Yeah. So this solution is a total of £180, and you have this set, and this set. So you have done a perfect set splitting here. That will not always be possible. Sometimes many items will remain. But you can see it's an NP-complete problem, of course. Now, this problem is not polynomial solvable, even if this hypergraph is acyclic. It remains NP-complete, even for acyclic hypergraphs. Yeah? It's not a constraint satisfaction problem. It's a much more complicated, intricate problem. Yeah? But what we have seen is the following. There is the notion of a dual hypergraph. I'm sorry for the overloading of the star. Before that, H star was another hypergraph. Anyway, there's a dual hypergraph, H star of H. For each hypergraph, we can define a dual. The vertices of the dual hypergraph are equal to the edges of the original hypergraph. And the edges of the dual are equal to the sets of edges for each single vertex in which this vertex is contained. Okay, so if we have here a hypergraph, the dual hypergraph, vertices become edges and edges become vertices, basically. And what we have very recently shown is that determining an optimal solution to a combinatorial auction is tractable if H star has bounded hypertrivies. Yeah? And again, here hypertrivies is a very sensible notion because in many applications you have bidders who bid on many, many items. So the trivies itself wouldn't be a very good measure. And with this, I want to finish.
So, it seemed it was very important to you that determining whether you have the composition of a fixed bound, that this is tractable.
Yes.
But I want to challenge this because it's not clear to me at all why this would be important. Because as we know, in this problem, you know, we have at least exponential in K. And what you really need as a polynomial time heuristic that will give you the best composition you can get. And in that sense, actually, the hypertrivial composition are too restrictive. It might be easier, once I take this approach, just get me a heuristic that will give me some, whatever the composition I can get, I might as well shoot for GHDs, because they're less restrictive.
Yes.
So I think actually in practice, if you really want to do it to use concerned selection problems, I would go for GHD rather than for HD.
Yes, that's what we actually do. But it's still interesting to see if something is polynomial or NP-hard, no? Otherwise, if we had here, I mean, first of all, for low hypertrivias, it's really very often. I mean, if you want to have an optimum thing here, yeah.
Yeah, but unless it's very very low.
Yeah, but
very quickly it blows up.
Yes, but I mean, so you say it's not interesting to know that something is hard or that to have some polynomial approximation.
No, I'm saying that if you're interested, you really think about it as a method to solve concerned selection problem, then you want actually the least restrictive notion.
That's what we do in practice. In practice, we do that, exactly what you say. So we are finding good heuristics
for hypertrophic composition,
for generalized hypertrophic, for generalized hypertrophic. That's what we do. So what we are doing actually, I didn't report about this because this is a kind of theoretical conference, but we have software that does it very well now, better than actually you students. Moshe's student was visiting us, but in the meantime,
you're building on the shoulders of giants.
Yes. But we have very good heuristics, yeah. And basically, what these heuristics are doing is the following: they are trying to find separators of a hypergraph, yeah. And separators, once we have separated the hypergraph, it's not obvious how to build a generalized hypertrophic decomposition it's easier to build a generalized than a classical hypertrophic decomposition, a non-generalized hypertrophic decomposition. So we are trying to find small separators of a hypergraph in a very fast way with heuristics, and then we build, so the separator separates the hypergraph in two components, yeah, and then we continue recursively with this. It's not completely trivial, but we have some good methods, and so we had two different heuristics. So one is a bottom-up heuristic, and one is a top-down, heuristic that remembers which node, which separators were already visited. And we now have a program that performs quite well. I mean, not as nicely as we wish, yeah, but it performs pretty well. Yeah, that's one thing. And the second, I mean, of course, it's interesting, at least theoretically, to know that there is a notion that is polynomial, which approximates hypertrivias. Also, if you have queries that are really, if you have constrained satisfaction problems, yeah, where the data vary, the constraint relations vary very very often, but the problem is very long, but still, yeah, then it's still worth to find an optimal decomposition. Yeah, so that depends on the situation. But I mean, I agree. What in practice you need is actually heuristics, and that's so I have two or three people working on heuristics in Vienna, actually. Yeah. The problem is heuristics is very nice, but they don't buy you so much. You can't write so many nice papers, because papers with heuristics, yeah, where do you publish them? And there are so many papers with heuristics sent everywhere, and everybody says my heuristic is better and has some tables. Yeah, so it doesn't pay very much to students, yeah, to do that. So it, as you may have noticed also, yeah. So it's a little problem. Yeah? It's a problem. Yeah? It's really a problem. I mean, I would like to have more students with heuristics. Yeah, but I probably shouldn't take students who want to do a scientific career. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's the right thing to do heuristics, but it's so much harder to publish heuristics than a theorem.
It would be very sad if it's the right thing for science and the wrong thing for the science.
Yes. Yeah.
Who's going to win the football tonight?
Who is? Sorry?
Who's going to win the football?
To win the football, yeah. At 7.
Oh,
today is Italy. What is today?
It's Germany.
Germany? Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not German. I'm not.
You're pretty involved into this, no?
Germany will win, but. Yeah. Thanks.